Hello and welcome to edition number 2113 of the Whitney Talking News, which we're recording as usual in the High Street Methodist Church in Whitney today, Thursday the 18th of June. My name's Byron Russell and I'm the editor on this edition. Our readers today are Anne Norris, Valerie Palmer, Adam Lethbridge and John Ashwell. Our technical expert is Eric Imeson, and he is here beside me at the mixing desk, ensuring that this week's recordings run smoothly. This week we have news and editorial items from the Whitney Gazette, the BBC, and the Chipping Norton News, and also a special reflection from David Sarbutz. In part two of this edition, we have a short piece about an amazing sporting feat and, by complete contrast, about the humble guinea pig. But first, we have part one, and we start with Anne to tell us about gridlock fears as ever more homes are built in the region.
The headline is A40 gridlock warning over plan for 10,000 new more homes. There are fears of gridlock on the A40 in West Oxfordshire amid plans to build 12,000 homes along the route. Whitney MP Charlie Maynard said transport improvements were essential for the district, considering proposals for ongoing and future growth. Under the National Planning Policy Framework, the area is being forced to accommodate around 15,000 homes between 2025 and 2041, with 12,000 to be delivered along the A40 corridor. He said, "The Labour government is demanding our area takes on a huge number of extra houses, adding more than 30% in the district's housing stock in under 20 years. Much of this development is planned along the already congested A40 corridor. Peak hour journeys between Carterton and Oxford can take almost 2 hours, with the S1 bus travelling at an average speed of just 11 miles per hour between Whitney and Oxford. Even outside peak periods, average speeds rise only marginally to 16 miles per hour. Developments are proposed across the area, with some of the biggest near Bryce Norton, site of the UK's largest RAF base. In late May, plans for a new 2,700 home town called New Ashtrop, next to the village, were announced, with a separate 2,500 home scheme north of Bryce Norton, proposed by Bloor Homes and Oxford University College, Christchurch, this year. These are moving forward as 700 home Bryce Meadow is delivered, and Les Gobble, chair of the parish council, said they were fighting to keep our identity. Mr Maynard said new homes would add to already congested transport links, causing businesses to move elsewhere. This includes Siemens, which will be moving to Bicester from Aynsham by 2030. I questioned whether this scale of housing is appropriate in West Oxfordshire in any circumstances, he said, and certainly not unless there is a major improvement in public transport, which can provide a fast, reliable green mass transport solution. As such, he has said he is concerned the proposed West Oxfordshire Lowlands Movement and Place Plan, which made headlines over suggestions it might impact free parking, does not address the region's transport challenges. As such, he urged Oxfordshire County Council to complete its transport modality study, which will examine potential solutions as quickly as possible so it can inform future strategic documents. One suggestion he made was for a train link in the area, which he claims will cut journey times by more than 70%. A study in 2025 commissioned by the District Council and carried out by consultants Litchfields found that the benefits of a Carterton-Whitney-Oxford rail corridor could almost double the cost. However, opposition politicians questioned whether it was a realistic hope considering the amount it would cost. Leader of the Oxfordshire Conservatives, Liam Walker, called it a fantasy project and argued that energy would be better spent on upgrading existing stations at Hamborough and the Cotswolds.
Thanks very much, Anne. We can look forward to plenty of traffic jams in the future. As you may know also, there are now new and fairly strict rules about recycling centres. The new rules are causing a lot of controversy. Adam, tell us more.
Thank you very much. Well, the title of this article is Review Sort of the Recycling Centre Booking System. And it reads as follows. An Oxfordshire councillor has demanded a review of the recycling centre booking system, arguing that the impact it has on the elderly is too restrictive. Oxfordshire County Council introduced a booking system at all waste centres across the county in January. Anyone visiting a household waste recycling centre must now book a slot online before taking their rubbish and show proof of address when they arrive. Bookings are available up to 2 weeks in advance or 30 minutes prior, subject to availability. To book a slot, visitors have to enter their own details, choose the centre they will be attending, enter the type of waste they are taking, and choose a date and a time. Councillor Lee Evans, the councillor for Kingston and Stanford, said in a statement on Facebook, "Next week, alongside Councillor Sally, I will be proposing a motion at the Vale of Whitehorse District Council about the new rules for using TIPS, or Household Waste Recycling Centres." Councillor Evans, who voted against the change, said, "Since the new rules were introduced in January, many residents have contacted me with concerns that the system is too complicated, too restrictive, and may create particular difficulties for elderly residents and those who are offline. There are also concerns that the changes could lead to more fly tipping and or more waste going into black bins, both of which have knock-on effects for the district council." However, in a recent study, DEFRA, Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, analysed data from 54 local authorities and concluded that there was no evidence of a link between booking systems and fly tipping. Most residents in Oxfordshire agreed that the scheme is easier and more arranged, but argued that the costs for elderly and disabled people outweighed the benefits. One resident said, "Okay, let's make people book, but not everyone is computer literate, so no access to the internet, and so they can't use the tip. The option could be to smash it all up and put it into refuse bins or litter bins or fly tip." Another said, "I think it's made it very difficult for seniors to use. This world is forgetting to look after our elderly who might struggle with technology." Another said, "However, I am concerned about access to the booking system. Not everyone is computer literate or wants to use online platforms for various reasons." A spokesperson for Oxfordshire County Council said, "Fly tipping has been closely monitored with district councils. To date, there has not been an observed increase in fly tipping attributable to the updated HWRC, that's TIPS services, nor any new trends emerging more generally since these changes were introduced. Furthermore, it is clear that the public are planning better by bringing more waste on each visit and separating out more material for recycling. This is reducing volumes of waste sent for incineration or to landfill, which is a worse option environmentally, as well as being more costly to the taxpayer."
And now about more controversial plans, this time plans to reform policing. And it seems from the article that reform isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be. Tell us more, Valerie.
Yes, this article is entitled PCC Warns Police Shake-Up Could Mean Years of Chaos. Plans to reform policing in England and Wales have come under fire for threatening public safety and weakening local accountability. Thames Valley Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Barber recently published a detailed response to the government's police reform white paper, outlining major concerns about the proposed changes. In a letter to the Home Secretary, Mr. Barber warned that the reforms represent the most significant overhaul of policing in generations and risk creating a policing system that is more distant from their communities and less accountable. He said, "It is not necessarily the size of forces that is the problem, but the funding formula that penalises them. The first stage of any review should be to look at how local policing is funded, not reviewing the geographical boundaries. A central concern is the plan to reorganise the long-standing 43 force structure in England and Wales." Mr. Barber argued that the real issue lies with police funding, not force size. He cautioned that structural changes could result in years of chaos, costing millions of pounds without bringing real benefit. "Almost any merger involving Thames Valley," he said, "would likely result in higher council tax costs and a lower level of service, which is more removed from their community." Another major worry is the increasing centralisation of police oversight. Under the proposals, the Home Office would gain expanded powers with more strategic oversight and strengthened powers to intervene in the performance and standards of police forces. Mr. Barber said, "These changes risk concentrating power in Whitehall, eroding the operational independence that underpins public trust in policing, as well as local governance and police accountability to the communities they serve." He also criticised plans to introduce a licence to practice for officers, describing it as an unnecessary bureaucratic burden that could reduce frontline capacity. Taken together, he warned the reforms could lead to fewer visible officers, less responsive policing, and higher levels of neighbourhood crime. He said, "Of course, policing must continue to modernise. If reform is to take place, however, it must be about strengthening policing, not weakening it. I'm extremely concerned that these proposals will lead to fewer resources and poorer performance, whilst fundamentally damaging the nature of policing in our country. But there is still time to change course in the interests of keeping the public safe."
Thanks very much, Valerie. And now more about reform, but this time it's the reforming of local councils. John, tell us about it.
Headed up, unitary councils set to reshape services. An overhaul of how Oxfordshire councils are run could soon reshape local government and the services residents rely on. Councils across the county are preparing for a major restructure, with a government announcement on the future shape of local government expected in July. The plans stem from the government's consultation on local government reorganisations, that's LGR, which closed last March and explores new models for council structures in areas where the council and districts format. Three unitary authorities options are on the table, with each proposing a different way to streamline services and reduce duplication. Council leaders and chief executives from the affected areas issued a joint statement outlining their approach. They said, "Since the start of the year, colleagues across Oxfordshire and West Berkshire councils have been working together with a joint programme to prepare for what comes next. Following the statutory consultation, we have been collaborating together a variety of data and information so we are ready to move forward whichever option gets the go-ahead from the government. We're also thinking through the potential implications of each option, planning for how we would deliver services under one, two or three new unitary councils to ensure we are ready to support our communities and colleagues through the changes ahead." Whatever change government proposes, our priority is to make sure we continue to deliver high-quality services to the people we serve during transition and beyond. Similar changes from two-tier local government to unitary councils have happened in many other parts of the country and are in progress. We will follow good practices as we plan ahead, collaborating during the remainder of 2006, 2027 and early 2028. The government is expected to make its provisional minded to decision before the parliamentary summer recess. Detailed legal and operational planning will follow once the announcement is made, with further steps expected to be laid out in late 2026. One option would establish a single Oxfordshire county responsible for all services, while another proposes two unitary councils. That would be Oxford and Shires Council, which will be Cherwell, Oxfordshire City, West Oxfordshire, and Ridgeway Council, which will be South Oxfordshire, Vale of Whitehorse and West Berkshire. A third option suggests three councils, which will be the Greater Oxford Council, which will cover Oxford and its immediate surroundings. Northern Oxfordshire Council would cover most of the existing Cherwell and West Oxfordshire districts. And Ridgeway Council would cover most of the existing South Oxfordshire of Whitehorse districts, combined with West Berkshire. Under the scenario, the LGR aims to create simple, more cost-effective government by bringing all services under one council per area.
The next article is headed Villagers Mark Completing Purchase of Historic Chapel. A major milestone has been marked in the village's long-running campaign to secure its historic chapel for community use. Villagers in Freeland, near Whitney, gathered to celebrate the completion of the purchase. Villagers were invited on Friday of last week to enjoy a glass of sparkling wine and a piece of cake and have a look around the chapel that will become Freeland's future community hub. The Community Benefit Society, called Freeland Community Hub, purchased the Grade 2 listed former Methodist chapel for just over £165,000 plus fees. It was previously reported that the asking price for the church in Roslyn Road was £175,000. The acquisition was funded entirely through fundraising, with local residents and supporters contributing around £187,000 to secure the building outright. The success means the society, which now has more than 160 shareholding members in and around the village, owns the chapel free of borrowing, and thanks to extra income secured in recent weeks, has already set aside £78,000 towards refurbishment works. However, there is still significant work ahead, with a further £132,000 needed to complete the restoration and conversion project by next spring. Tom Harden, chairman of Freeland Community Hub, said, "Getting the keys was an incredibly special moment after years of effort from so many people across the village. Friday's celebration was a chance to thank everyone who has supported the project so far and to give people a first glimpse of the building's future. While we're delighted to have secured the chapel, this is only the beginning. We still have £132,000 to raise before we can complete the refurbishment and create the vibrant community space the village has worked so hard to achieve. Previous fundraising efforts include a Santa Fun Run before Christmas, which saw 85 people take part. The refurbishment project is being led by renowned local architect Maya Ellis and will be delivered using local builders and tradespeople wherever possible, helping to ensure the investment benefits the wider community. Plans for the chapel include creating a welcoming cafe during the day, run by Donna Byram, who manages the Oxfordshire Yeoman Pub opposite, and a flexible space for meetings, events, exhibitions and social activities at other times. The building has stood at the heart of Freeland since 1805, but has been emptied since 2017, when it closed primarily due to a continuously declining elderly congregation and mounting repair bills for the ageing Grade 2 listed building. Anyone interested in supporting the next phase of the project can find out more at www.freelandhub.org.uk.
The next article is about things that we don't see so much of these days, which is banknotes. And the headline is, Churchill is, quote, too divisive, unquote, to feature on £5 notes. Sir Winston Churchill was dropped from featuring on £5 notes because he was seen as, quote, divisive and elitist, it has emerged. The wartime leader, who was born at Blenheim Palace, has been praised over decades for rallying Britons during World War II to defeat fascism from Germany. But research carried out by market consultancy Savanta in October last year suggested that having the wartime Prime Minister on a note risked promoting a backward-looking vision of the UK that could prove divisive, the Telegraph reports. Other so-called controversial figures include codebreaker Alan Turing and novelist Jane Austen, who are viewed by some as being, quote, not representative of the UK's cultural and natural diversity. The report recommended banknotes should feature nature, arguing animals and the natural world would be less controversial. According to the paper, the findings were delivered to the Bank of England months before it announced plans to replace historic figures from notes. The Bank of England said the theme for the new banknotes was selected after a public consultation was launched in July last year and received 44,000 responses. Earlier this month, the Bank of England launched a consultation for the public to give their views on a selection of wildlife native to the UK that will appear on the next series of notes.
And now an article entitled Conservationist in Water Bike Effort. A 90-year-old explorer is taking on a marathon quest to raise funds for rainforest research. Robin Hanbury-Tennyson is riding a water bike 104 miles down the River Thames from Oxford to Teddington Lock, Richmond, to raise £150,000 for the Thousand Year Trust. The trust, led by his son Merlin, plans to use the funds to help build Europe's first temperate rainforest research station on Bodmin Moor. Mr. Hanbury-Tennyson begins the challenge at Magdalen Bridge, Oxford, on Friday, June the 19th, aiming to complete the equivalent of a marathon each day over 4 days, finishing at Teddington Lock on Monday, June the 22nd, International Rainforest Day. The journey marks another adventure for the celebrated conservationist, despite his age. Mr. Hanbury-Tennyson said, "At 90, you work with what you've got, and you keep going." He has spent decades exploring and protecting rainforests across the globe, but says the UK's own rainforest is almost forgotten. Mr. Hanbury-Tennyson said, "I've spent a lifetime exploring the world's great rainforests. What many people don't realise is that one of the most remarkable was right here on our own doorstep, and it's almost gone. I've seen what we've lost. I've reached an age where I feel rather urgently that if I'm going to do something about it, I better get on with it." Britain's temperate rainforest, once stretching along the Atlantic coast, is now reduced to fragmented and degraded patches. The Thousand Year Trust operates a 250-acre restoration site near Bodmin Moor. home to an ancient oak woodland more than 3,600 years old. The proposed research station, designed by Architects Unknown Works, will include laboratory facilities, a community hub, and a living roof. It will accommodate up to 12 researchers and support long-term ecological study. Merlin Hanbury Tennyson, founder and managing director of Thousand Year Trust, said, "My father has spent his life fighting for the natural world. To see him take on something like this at 90 for a cause we are now building together is extraordinary. This research station will give Britain's temperate rainforest the scientific home it has never had. We are asking people to help us make it a reality." Mr. Hanbury Tennyson will be supported by his son and Conservation Director Harrison Carter in an escort boat, with a film crew documenting the journey. He has trained for the challenge using an exercise bike and a pond near his home in Cornwall. All preparatory work for the research station, including legal, design and planning, has been completed and construction has begun. To donate, visit https://www.justgiving.com/campaign/waterbike challenge.
And this piece is headed "College Told Significant Improvement Needed." An Oxfordshire college has been told significant improvement is needed, with some areas needing urgent improvement. Carterton Community College in Upavon Way in Carterton was visited by Ofsted inspectors at the end of April for a routine inspection. The school was inspected in inclusion, which means leadership, well-being, post-16 provision, achievement, attendance, behaviour, curriculum and teaching. Under the new Ofsted framework, schools are rated in each area. Schools can receive either an exceptional or strong standard or expected standard, needs attention or urgent improvement rating in each of these seven areas. For this school, four areas were found to be in need of attention, while three areas were deemed needing urgent improvement, with no area reaching the expected standard. The chief inspector said that the school run by Oxfordshire County Council is performing significantly less well than it might in all the circumstances reasonably to be expected for it to perform. Although inspectors praised the teachers' interests of the school, they also highlighted that pupils do not develop a consistently secure understanding of key topics and values. The inspectors said they lack secure understanding of fundamental British values such as tolerance and democracy. Pupils lack knowledge in aspects such as cultural differences and spirituality. The inspection highlighted low examination results, leaving pupils not as well prepared as they need to be, therefore, for their next steps when they leave school. Pupils' attendance and behaviour are also recognised as poor, with low rates of attendance across year groups, and persistent rates of absences remaining low. The inspectors also said leaders are not doing enough to raise the levels of attendance. When pupils do attend, they do not engage in the learning well enough and go off task. Speaking on the curriculum, inspectors said the curriculum does not meet pupils' needs because it is not designed to address important gaps in their knowledge, including mathematics and writing. Teachers were also said to have a low expectation for pupils and lacked support for those with special educational needs and those who spoke English as an additional language. When the school was last visited in March 2022, it received an overall good grade an improvement from its previous score of requires improvement when it was inspected in May 2018. An Oxfordshire County Council spokesman said, "We are working closely with school leaders, governors and partners in developing and implementing a robust and focused plan to strengthen leadership and governance. There is a collective determination to achieve the very best outcome for every pupil."
The heading of our next article is "Most speeders are snared by mobile camera vans." New data shows 75% of speeding tickets handed out in Oxfordshire are from mobile speed camera vans. Thames Valley Police caught 9,823 instances of speeding in the county for 3 months during the summer between October and December, the newly published figures show. And of those, 7,404 vehicles were caught by somebody sat in a van with a speed gun at the side of the road. The worst area to get caught by a speed camera van is in the West Oxfordshire and Cherwell districts of the county, the data suggests, where 3,442 were caught in the 3 months. During the same period in the same districts, fixed speed cameras flashed just 54 times for speeding, the lowest data of the period in Oxfordshire by far. Meanwhile, in Oxford, more offences were clocked by a fixed speed camera than a mobile camera, at 1,672 clocked, compared with 1,259 caught by a parked van. This was a rise from the previous quarter, where fixed cameras flashed 1,433 times and mobile speed vans caught 1,173 vehicles. Over in South Oxfordshire and the Vale of the White Horse District Council areas, fixed speed cameras flashed 693 times, up from 1,162 times the previous quarter. Compared with 2,757 speeding offences clocked using a mobile speed camera van. Overall in Oxfordshire, fixed speed cameras flashed 2,419 times during the 3 months of summer, while mobile speed cameras recorded 7,404 instances of speeding. The data does not include Community Speed Watch, which over the same 3 months saw volunteers put in 279 hours, resulting in 3,341 letters being sent to motorists. Maria Jolliffe, a traffic management officer at Thames Valley Police, said, "We prioritise enforcement and education for drink and drug driving, the non-wearing of seat belts, excessive speed, careless driving and driving whilst distracted." She added, "Community Speed Watch is an educational scheme run by our local volunteers." The figures for the mobile camera enforcement are from our dedicated Safer Roads police staff, and the fixed penalty notices are from any officer on patrol dealing with a motorist. The minimum penalty for speeding is a fixed penalty fine of £100 and 3 points added to your licence. Receiving 12 or more points within 3 years may disqualify you from driving. Newly published provisional government statistics suggest that Oxfordshire is seeing significant improvements in road safety, with serious and fatal collisions falling sharply, while the wider Thames Valley area has seen increases. Tim Bearder, leader of Oxfordshire County Council, said the provisional data is extremely encouraging after the authority vowed to cut road deaths.
Now we have two short news items, and I'll be honest with you, the first one, I think being visually impaired probably is a bit of a blessing, because the headline is "Naked Man Sporting Black Rubber Head Mask." A naked man wearing a black rubber head mask was spotted walking along the River Thames. Police were called to the middle-aged man on the afternoon of June the 12th after he shocked passers-by. He was walking along the Thames at the somehow appropriately named Pink Hill Lock, off Oxford Road, not far from Aynsham, when he was spotted. Reports from concerned people say that he was wearing just a black rubber head mask, and presumably nothing else. A spokesman for the force said, "We were called about an exposure at Pink Hill Lock on Oxford Road, Aynsham, at 4:10 p.m. on Friday, June the 12th, but there was no sexual element, so no crime was committed, and the report was filed." And the second of my two short news items is headlined "New Parking Restrictions." And it reads as follows: "A raft of new parking restrictions, including double yellow lines on 20 Oxfordshire roads, are set for approval. New County Transport boss Gareth Epps will this week make decisions on planned road schemes, which could impact parking and driving in Witney, Oxford, Botley, Littlemore, Didcot and Shrivenham. In the city, Mr. Epps has received recommendations to exclude several properties across Lye Valley, Marston North, Summertown, Jericho and Cowley Marsh from applying for residence parking permits and visitors parking permits. This follows a consultation by the county council amid, quote, administrative stroke historic inconsistencies."
Today, we'd like to welcome David Sarbatz, who really needs no further introduction, as we all know him so well, for his regular thoughtful reflections on Witney Talking News. David, a pleasure to welcome you again.
Thank you so much. I recently heard on the radio the song Imagine, which is one of John Lennon's most famous songs, and I discovered it was released in 1971. It received bad press among Christians for its suggestion that there is no heaven. But the song gives a loud call for a change in the way we as humans relate to the world around us. Part of the lyrics say this: "Imagine there's no countries, no religion, no possessions, no need for greed or hunger." Yes, his vision might be unrealistic, and the last 55 years certainly haven't given us anything to think we're any closer to the brotherhood of man that he envisaged. Lennon's lyric included "imagine" in the beginning. Well, in the beginning, God created the world and told us humans to look after and care for it. Each of us have five senses, and it is reported that one man once said he lost his taste of smell the day he met his future wife. Being without any one of the senses, sight, touch, sound and smell, which most of us take for granted, must be very sad. At this time of the year, having no sense of smell means it is not possible to smell the scent of roses or even sweet peas, and although it is distressing, it is not disastrous. Not being able to see their colours takes away much of the pleasure and joy from what is around us. I have a newspaper cutting dated 4 September 2013. It's about a man. His name is Joe Robinson. I don't know whether he is still living. Joe had at that time, in September 2013, a garden in Crook, which is in County Durham. The article tells me that he grew the most incredible flowers, and there were over 20 hanging baskets containing masses of begonias, and his garden was so beautiful that he won many prizes and awards. He received compliments from friends and strangers alike for his stunning displays, despite the fact that Mr. Robinson was blind. His sight apparently began to deteriorate when he was quite young, and he had to retire early from work when he lost it completely. using touch and smell to help him, he said in the article that it never occurred to him to stop, although he did not grow roses, as the thorns were a problem. What I found a little ironic was the fact that his wife was unable to help him either, for she had an allergy to flowers. And that's another thing, we can lose our senses, or we can suffer an allergy that attacks them. I suffer from hay fever, so my eyes hurt at this time of the year. In times past, my allergy was so bad that my eyes would close up completely for a couple of days. Even if you lose one or two of the five senses, there are more to think about. Aristotle, the famous Greek philosopher, well before the time of Jesus, chatted with the wise men of his day. He said there were five: sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. Nowadays we know about more, such as pain, balance, joint motion, sense of time, sense of temperature differences, among others. Then there is the sixth sense, so-called the gift of being able to tell you when you are mowing the lawn that it is about to rain. Or the marigolds, other flowers and shrubs are available, that you have planted in the wrong place. And don't forget, of course, the female sense of knowing exactly what her husband is thinking. But the most important one of all is common sense. Not to worry, though. If a gardener can enjoy his garden even though he can't see, we should make the best of what we can do. So back to the song Imagine. We are made in the image of God, and our ability to imagine something that is outside our experience or beyond our current reality is part of that image. Our beautiful world was created by God for everyone to live in peace and harmony. We are called to dream, to see beyond, to imagine a better world, and we are called and challenged by our God to make this world a better place. So may each of us be blessed as we play our part to make the dream come true which God first set in place. Amen.
David, thank you very much for those thoughtful and reflective words. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, today is the 18th of June, and the 18th of June marks the anniversary of an extremely famous battle, which took place 211 years ago. On the 18th of June, 1815, two men faced off in a muddy field in Belgium. Of course, it wasn't just them, they had their armies with them. Had the outcome been any different, French rather than English might have been the global language. One man was the Duke of Wellington, with his army made up of British troops and Dutch, Belgian and German, or Prussian, soldiers. The other, of course, was Napoleon, with 72,000 men. Napoleon had been trying to create a European empire under his rule since 1804. Despite the destruction of his navy in 1805 by Horatio Nelson, Napoleon went on to invade countries across Europe before being forced to give up his imperial throne. He returned to Paris in March 1815, prompting Britain, Russia, Austria, and a historic state called Prussia, now part of Germany, to declare war. In June, Napoleon invaded Belgium, hoping to take over the capital. The Duke of Wellington and his army was waiting for him, and Napoleon sent his troops to take him on. At the same time, part of his army led an attack against General Blücher's Prussian troops, which beat a hasty retreat. The scene was set for a final battle with the British and their allies. The Prussians and Wellington's armies were now divided by several miles, and Napoleon was confident he could defeat the British. Wellington knew he was outnumbered, approximately 68,000 Allied troops against Napoleon's 72,000, So Wellington positioned his men behind a ridge and in three farms, Hougemont, Papelpot and La Haye Sainte, that could be heavily defended until the Prussians, hopefully, arrived to help him. Because of heavy rain, Napoleon decided to delay his first major attack until the ground had dried out. His first move was then to launch an attack on Hougemont Farm. 5,000 French troops headed to the farm, way outnumbering the 1,500 British defenders that were there. The attacks lasted all day, but at 12:30 they broke open the gates, but the British quickly closed them again, trapping an unfortunate 40 French soldiers inside. All of them were killed except one, an 11-year-old French drummer boy. With a big chunk of Wellington's army defending Hougemont, Napoleon took the opportunity to send 18,000 soldiers along the road to Brussels to capture the farms of Papelpot and the surrounding area. It looked like victory was now within Napoleon's grasp. If he took both farms, he could attack the remaining British troops at close range with his cavalry and cannon. But at around 1 p.m. looking through his telescope, Napoleon saw something on the horizon and sent a troop of horsemen to investigate. It was the Prussians who had come to help Wellington and his allies. Napoleon sent out his own cavalry to face them, and they met near a village 5 miles east of the battlefield. After fierce fighting, the Prussians were able to defeat them and took over the high ground northeast of the village. This led to Napoleon sending even more troops over to try and win back the high ground, meaning the French army was split up. But the Prussians were still some 5 miles from Wellington's troops, quite a long way to offer real assistance. Wellington could hear the cannon fire in the distance. He knew the Prussians were doing what they could to help him. Napoleon's men were now fighting on both the west and east sides of the battlefield. He ordered one of his men, Marshal Ney, to attack the area where Wellington had the most troops, and for the next 2 hours, wave after wave of heavily armoured French soldiers on horseback charged at them. The British managed to hold off the 4,000-strong French attack, but their new formation, in squares rather than long lines, made them a much easier target for Napoleon's heavy cannon fire. After hours under attack, Wellington finally lost the area where his strongest army had been fighting. It was a crushing blow. Napoleon was now able to bring the French gunners forward and attack the rest of his troops. All Wellington could do was fight back as much as possible and wait and hope for the Prussians to help. His men waited in the long grass behind the ridge as the French Imperial Guard headed towards them. When they reached the ridge, Wellington gave the order to stand and fire. At the same time, the Prussians started to arrive. They joined forces with the British and attacked the French Imperial Guard, Napoleon's finest troops. Under heavy fire, the Imperial Guard were defeated. Seeing this, the rest of Napoleon's army panicked and fled. Wellington had a chance to kill Napoleon, but ordered his men to hold fire, and the Emperor was shielded by his men as they all fled. The Battle of Waterloo was over. Wellington had won, but at a tremendous cost, with over 22,000 men killed or wounded. Napoleon's army fared still worse. Nearly 40,000 men were killed, wounded, or captured. It was, said Wellington, a damn close run thing, the nearest run thing you ever saw in your life. The victorious Allies entered Paris on the 7th of July. To ensure he could never again threaten peace in Europe, Napoleon was sent to the remote island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic, where he died in 1821. And now it's time for part two. And the following deaths were reported in the Whitney Gazette this week. On May the 16th, Christopher Tolley, at the age of 66. On May the 18th, Linda Godfrey, aged 70. On May the 23rd, Peter Claude Batts, aged 87. On June the 7th, Barry Leslie Taylor, aged 92. And with no date given, James Wally, who passed away peacefully this month at the age of 77. Our condolences to all their friends and families from all of us here at Whitney Talking News. Moving on now to our quiz, and here are the answers to last week's quiz. Jolly good luck to all our readers in answering these. So question number one, what breed of dog is Snoopy, the pet dog of Charlie Brown in the Peanuts comic strip?
A beagle.
He's a beagle, yep, he is indeed. Question number two, marathons, swimming the channel, round the world yacht races and Le Mans 24-hour race are what type of event beginning with the letter E?
Endurance.
Yes. Oh, wow. Everyone's on the ball tonight. Great. Question three. Oh, this is a bit trickier. Well, for me, anyway. Which U.S. state is bordered by New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, and California?
Arizona.
Yeah.
It is indeed Arizona. Yep. Number four. Which capital city stands on the banks of the River Lagan, if that's how you pronounce it, and is famous for being the location of the shipyard where the RMS Titanic was built?
Oh.
Belfast. Yep.
Yeah.
And question five. Henry VIII had two sisters who both became queens. His elder sister, Margaret, became Queen of Scotland, and his younger sister, for a very short time, became Queen of France. What was his youngest sister's first name?
Mary.
Well done. Yeah, impressive.
I was a history teacher.
Oh, that's cheating.
And now there's a bonus question. Each of the answers you have just given has a common link. What is the link? It's a bit tricky, that one.
Beagle, Arizona.
Yep. Endurance.
Ship names.
Yes, they're all ship names. HMS Beagle carried Charles Darwin around the world in the 1830s. HMS Endurance was Ernest Shackleton's ship that was crushed by ice in 1915. USS Arizona was destroyed at Pearl Harbor in 1941. HMS Belfast was launched on St. Patrick's Day in 1938 and is now permanently moored on the Thames. And the Mary Rose was named after Henry VIII's sister and unfortunately sank in the Solent in 1545. And now for this week's quiz, which is all about June. June, of course, is named after Juno, the wife of Jupiter in Roman mythology. But for question number one, what was she actually the goddess of? And there's a choice here, they're all multiple choice questions. A, women and family. B, agriculture and crops, or C, fields and meadows. Number two, June the 19th, or Juneteenth, is an American holiday celebrating what? A, the Declaration of Independence. B, the Battle of Gettysburg. C, the abolition of slavery. Number three, George Orwell's classic, 1984, was published in June of which year? A, 1948, B, 1933, or C, 1949? Number four. In 1956, on June the 5th, Elvis Presley first publicly performed which famous song? Was it A, Blue Suede Shoes, B, Hound Dog, or C, Jailhouse Rock? And finally, number five, D-Day, or Operation Overlord, marked the turning point in World War II and took place in June 1944. But on which date? June the 1st, June the 9th, or June the 6th? Well, good luck with all those. Hope you got them all right. There are no prizes, of course, as ever. And now we go back to our news, and we start off with Valerie and an article about a really amazing local triathlete.
Yes, this article is really very encouraging. Gold medalist sets triathlon's record. An Olympic medalist set a new world record after completing 10 sprint distance triathlons back to back in just one weekend. More than 6,000 athletes of all ages and abilities took part in Super Tri Blenheim Palace, a triathlon festival held in the Woodstock stately home, including first-timers and seasoned professionals alike. Among them was Johnny Brownlee, who completed the grueling Weekend Warrior Challenge in a record-breaking time of 12 hours, 24 minutes and 25 seconds, covering 7.5 kilometres of swimming, 200 kilometres of cycling and 50 kilometres of running on the closed course. Mr. Brownlee said, "This challenge is what sport is all about. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, it's all about every second counts. Am I missing training by being here? I can't talk to people because I need to focus on my race. Now I realise that sport is more than that. It's great to see everyone over the weekend have their own challenges and goals, helping and inspiring each other along the way. I love seeing people be active and doing sport. I got inspiration from people as I went around." He also credited his family for motivating him during the event. He said, "Fee, Johnny's wife, and Freddie are a massive support, and when I was getting a bit tired on Saturday night, I thought all I had to do was get to the finish line and I could give Fee and Freddie a big cuddle and it's all okay." Your perspective changes in life. When I raced here in 2012, I would never have thought I would say this, but there are more important things in life than sport. The event featured a scenic course, including a swim in Blenheim Palace's Great Lake, a closed road bike ride through the estate and surrounding countryside, and a run through the palace grounds. The event also featured the Super Tri Pro Series, where home favourite Ollie Conway won the men's race with a time of 55 minutes and 51 seconds, while Belgium's Jolien Vermeylen took the women's title in 1 hour, 2 minutes and 18 seconds. Michael Holst, CEO of Supertri, praised the weekend's turnout. He said, "To see more than 6,000 people come together at Supertri Blenheim Palace and challenge themselves is incredibly special. Whether it was someone's first ever triathlon or they were racing alongside Olympic champions, every participant had their own story and achievement to celebrate. Entries for the 2027 event are already open, with organising urging participants to register early to secure a place and take advantage of launch pricing." And accompanying this article is a lovely photo of Johnny Brownlee at the end of the race, smiling, wearing medals, and with his little boy Freddie in his arms, who is looking totally disinterested.
Co-op opens millions in funding for grassroots projects. Community groups are being invited to apply for funding to support grassroots projects. Oxfordshire charities and groups have the opportunity to receive financial support through the Co-op's Local Community Fund, which is distributing a total of £3.5 million across the UK. The funding is available to causes that help improve access to food, support mental well-being, create opportunities for young people, promote community cohesion, or contribute to building sustainable futures. David Luckin, Head of Social Value and Common Engagement at Co-op, said, "Beginning the searches for new local causes takes part in a fresh round of funding is always exciting. Our members have told us they want Co-op to focus on the real issues affecting the people's lives. Cooperation and people working together can be very powerful, and our funding enables local causes to deliver projects which focus on issues that matter to most to locally." The Co-op says that since launching the fund in 2016, Co-op members have helped support 40,000 causes across the UK. Co-op members can supply a cause in their area by selecting it through the co-op members app. Mr. Luckett said that funding helps bring the positive change where it is needed most, especially as many communities continue to face significant challenges.
Greggs has new bigger shop in town. Greggs has opened a new shop in Witney. The refreshed and expanded store in Welsh Way brings three new roles and offers more space for customers to enjoy Greggs's full range of food and drink options. Jonathan De Silva, shop manager, said, "We can't wait to welcome Greggs fans and new customers to our new shop. We've got an amazing range of iconic savouries, fair trade hot drinks, hot food and healthier choices available for takeaway, sit-in or click and collect. Customers will be able to enjoy a wide selection of familiar favourites, including sausage rolls, steak bakes and vegan roll. Greggs's latest addition, the chicken roll, is now available at the Witney location. The summer menu also includes new pasta and salad options, such as a prawn-layered pasta salad and chicken Caesar salad with egg. For evening visitors, hot food like southern fried chicken goujons and sweet treats such as hot cinnamon yum-yums are on offer, alongside popular pizza slices including chicken tandoori, barbecue chicken and bacon, and the veggie feast.
And finally, if you are a fan of guinea pigs and you would like to give one a new home, listen on. So the headline is, Charity Helps Out in Guinea Pigs Rescue. Over 200 guinea pigs were rescued from a home in Wales, with over 60 now sent to Oxfordshire. The animals arrived at the Blue Cross Rehoming Centre in Burford after being rescued from a home in Wales where 224 had been kept in a shed. A total of 56 guinea pigs were taken in by the charity, with the remaining animals placed in 22 rescue centres across the country. But that number could double, as many of the guinea pigs are pregnant. Anushka Ashmead Bartlett, admissions coordinator at Blue Cross in Burford, said, "We are so grateful that the owner reached out for help. We were among a number of charities to visit the home and help to take the guinea pigs away. All 224 guinea pigs are now out of the home and in our and other rescues' care. Thankfully, they are in good condition, and as they're mostly females, we've had a few babies born on site already and a few more confirmed pregnancies, so we'll be welcoming more youngsters very soon. Due to the large amount coming in, we have doubled our number of small animals we have on site, and people on other sections and management have been supporting with their own care. It has been a real team effort. We'll be looking for loving new homes for them once they're ready to go up for rehoming." The situation comes as a survey by the charity revealed the financial strain facing pet owners. Research by Blue Cross found that one in five owners could not afford an unexpected £600 veterinary bill. If costs rose to £3,500, almost half said that they would be unable to pay, and nearly three quarters would need to borrow money or go into debt. The charity also discovered that nearly a quarter of owners have skipped meals to afford pet food, while others have cut back on heating. One in 10 owners said that they had already surrendered a pet due to financial pressures, with a further one in 10 seriously considering it. Almost half fear they may soon have no choice. Blue Cross has seen the impact of these challenges firsthand, with the number of dogs arriving at its rehoming centre rising by 122% in the past 4 years. Arrivals of cats have also increased by 80% in the same period. Ms. Ashmead Bartlett said, "We know so many people are struggling right now, and we'd urge anyone who needs help, advice or support to contact us or another charity for help as soon as possible, so that we can discuss the options available for help. And there is a charming picture of one of the rescued guinea pigs, and the image is from the Blue Cross.
Thanks, Adam. So if you're considering a low-cost, low-maintenance guinea pig as a possible pet, you know where to go. It's the Blue Cross. Now, it's time for our notice board. And there are a few events taking place in the next week or so, but first, we've got a few birthdays to celebrate. On June the 15th, happy birthday to Mr. Robert Shirley. And tomorrow, June the 19th, we have Mrs. Judith Humphreys and Mrs. Anne Martin. Judith, if you're listening, I saw that you're born on the same year as I was, but I'm not going to give the date away. From the 11th to the 23rd of June, the Burford Festival is now on, celebrating art, history, gardens, music and performances, including, what sounds very intriguing, a dragon parade on June the 21st. For more details, see www.burfordfestival.org. On the 27th of June, the Charlbury Beer Festival is a date for your diary if you're a beer lover or if you just want a fun social event. It's the 28th anniversary too, so there is beer, cider, wine, food and live music, plus the 2026 World Aunt Sally Championships. For more information, go to Charlbury Beer Festival, that's all one word, charlburybeerfestival.org. On the 21st of June at 7:30 p.m. in the Church of St. John the Baptist in Burford, there'll be the summer concert celebrating the works of three much-loved composers, including Benjamin Britten. To book, just go to Burford Singers, again, all one word, burfordsingers.org.uk. And finally, still on the musical theme, here's advance notice that the Dean and Chadlington Summer Music Festival will take place from the 2nd to the 5th of July at the Theatre Chipping Norton, with an excellent range of performers and concerts. For more details or to book tickets, just call 07884 043712. That's 07884 043712. So that's all for this week. If you're not listening online and have a USB memory stick, please remove the stick from the playback unit and close the metal shield. Remember to reverse the plastic address label on the yellow or blue pouch before posting the stick back to us in any postbox. You don't need to take it to a post office. If you wish to contact us, just leave a slip of paper in your pouch and we'll give you a call. As well as listening to the USB stick some of you get from us each week, there are several other ways for you to listen to all our editions, including the magazine. Whitney Talking News is available completely for free online via our website, wtn.org.uk. And please remember to pass on the details to anyone who might like to listen to your weekly local news programme. And please keep listening at the end of our programme for an info sound item, which gives some highlights of the week's best radio listening and audio described TV. Finally, a big thanks to all our readers tonight, Anne Norris, Valerie Palmer, Adam Lethbridge and John Ashwell, and of course to David Sarbucks for his reflection. Thanks to our support team, to Eric Imerson, who's recorded this session on our computer, to Rachel Fielder and Lynn Harding, who have been checking the pouches and memory sticks you have returned, and keeping all our admin records in good order. And a second thank you to John, who will be copying the USB sticks with me after the recording, ready to send out to you all. Now, as you'll undoubtedly remember, we're ending every programme with a joke. So here's this week's. The other day, I had to take my son to the hospital. The doctor asked what had happened, and I said a row of books fell on his head. The doctor said, well, he's only got his shelf to blame. I'm sure that after that, everyone would like to say goodbye. And so until our next edition,
goodbye.
Goodbye.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, June 20th. A Fatal Inversion, dramatisation of the award-winning 1987 crime novel by Ruth Rendell, published under her Barbara Vine alias. It's 1976 and an idyllic hot summer for Adam and his friends. But when the weather breaks, lives are wrecked. Radio 4 Extra, 5 o'clock, Saturday afternoon. Opera on 3 presents a Royal Opera House performance from last month of Britain's breakthrough opera, Peter Grimes, in an Olivier-nominated production by Deborah Warner, first staged in 2022, which shifts the action from the 19th century to a depressed contemporary coastal town. Alan Clayton as Peter Grimes, Bryn Terfel as Captain Bulstrode, and Maria Begston as Ellen Orford. Opera on 3, Radio 3, 6 p.m. Finally for Saturday, Midsummer Dreaming, from sunset to sunrise on the summer solstice. Verity Shah presents a dreamlike night of radio documentaries from Radio 3's archives, a celebration of the vast imaginative possibilities of the radio, and between the years, Radio 3's own strand of innovative feature-making that was launched in 1993. Midsummer Dreaming, Radio 3, 9:30, Saturday night. Sunday, June 21st, 10 years after Brexit, Tribal, a thought-provoking analysis by Professor James Tilley on how the referendum forced people to pick a side, creating two identities and demonstrating the impact of tribalism in politics. 10 years after Brexit, Tribal, Radio 4, 1:30, Sunday afternoon. Radio 3's Sunday feature is entitled Leon Bosch, The Double Bass and the Children of Soweto. In 1976, the British South African double bassist Leon Bosch took part in the Soweto Uprising, which led to his incarceration and eventual self-exile from his home country. 50 years later, he explores how he learnt to confront trauma and speak through the voice of his instrument. Sunday feature, Radio 3, 7 p.m. And if we can walk together, the story of how a Palestinian and an Israeli, both of whom have lost family members to violence, are together searching for peace. They discuss their efforts to build peace and understanding between themselves and through their communities, what cost of it is, and how they deal with the legacy of historic hatred and enmity. 7:15, Radio 4, Sunday night. On to programmes then, and the broadcast at the same time each day, all week, Monday to Friday. So same time, same radio station, each day. Metamorphosis, how insects transformed our world. Radio 4 Extra, all week, Monday to Friday, 9:30. How to spot potential. Kate Mason explores human potential in different fields, beginning with sport and continuing with education, music, the world of work and technology. Radio 4, 11:45 in the morning, Monday to Friday. In Tony Hawk's Just Wants to Play, the comedian explores the barriers preventing everyone from accessing play, sport and nature in the UK. The first episode focuses on Wimbledon and whether Britain's tennis culture is truly accessible to everyone. Radio 4, 1:45, all week, Monday to Friday, Tony Hawk's Just Wants to Play. Henry Purcell is the subject of Composer of the Week, and Donald MacLeod explores London during Purcell's lifetime, investigating the city's effect on the man who lay claim to being England's greatest composer. Radio 3, Composer of the Week, 4 o'clock. All week. This week's The Essay is entitled Jazz Among the British. This series, produced in 2020 by jazz specialist broadcaster Geoffrey Smith, who died in April, explores the changing perceptions and appreciation of jazz in Britain through his experience as an American settling in the UK in 1973. The Essay, Radio 3, all week, Monday to Friday, 9:45 p.m. And Book of Bedtime continues, Land by Maggie O'Farrell, the latest offering from the author of Hamnet, which of course recently on at the cinema. Book of Bedtime, Radio 4, Land, 10:45 p.m. On to the rest of the radio highlights for the week, for each individual day. Monday, June 22nd. a new series of The Patch, in which producers visit parts of the country chosen by a random postcode generator. It begins with Dagenham Dock, where they discover a battle between HGV drivers and a parking fine company. 11 a.m, Monday morning, Radio 4. In 10 years after Brexit, Ireland and the border poll, Belfast-born Andrea Catherwood explores changing attitudes to a united Ireland in the wake of Brexit, re-examining the broken promises and new trading arrangements in the Irish Sea. 4 o'clock, Monday afternoon, Radio 4. And Limelight and Galapagos, a five-part play by Andrew Day and Simon Scardfield. Bryony is offered the job of a lifetime, but who is her new employer? 11 o'clock, Monday night, Radio 4. Tuesday, June 23rd. Being Greek is a new five-part series presented by Mary Beard. Five compelling stories from ancient Greece, beginning with a courtroom drama. Euphilates, on trial for the murder of his wife's lover, tried to convince the jury that it was a crime of passion rather than a calculated act of mob violence. Radio 4, Being Greek, 9 a.m, Tuesday. I'm Stuck In Here is a delightful documentary about Ian Sansom, finding himself stuck in audio documentaries. One moment he's in a London sewer with a man called Gary, the next he's in the Australian outback with a producer who avoids birdsong, and finds himself sipping whiskey with American ladies who love cats. Radio 4 Extra on Tuesday, 10:30 in the morning, 4:30 in the afternoon, or just after midnight if you prefer. In the studio, acclaimed musician Sean Cooney, winner of 3 BBC Radio 2 Folk Awards, explains why he's decided to craft an album devoted entirely to dogs. Hollywood stars and real-life heroes, including his wife's guide dog, Nessie, who's just retired after 8 years' service. In the studio, 1:30, World Service, on Tuesday afternoon, or 10:30 at night. And don't forget, as it's a Tuesday, In Touch, the programme of news for the blind and partially sighted, 8:40 p.m, Radio 4. Wednesday, June 24th. Scoop, the story of ice cream, from disputes about the origins of the 99 in the 1920s to the Glasgow ice cream wars of the 80s, and what makes the perfect gelato. And did Margaret Thatcher really help to invent Mr. Whippy? 10 a.m. or 4 p.m, Radio 4 Extra. Also on Wednesday, in Finding Sea Glass, Hannah Lavery performs her poetic exploration of Scottish history through the prism of the loss of her father and her experiences of growing up mixed race. 2:15, Wednesday afternoon, Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert presents a concert for May 16th at the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, featuring the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra in a programme of Scandinavian music. Sibelius's Violin Concerto, Nielsen's Fifth Symphony, and Ratavora's Cantus Arcticus, 7:30 p.m, Radio 3. Thursday, June 25th. With the FIFA World Cup in full swing, football enthusiasts may be interested in the documentary Agony and Ecstasy, A History of Penalty Shootouts. Football, in its purest form, is one view of the dreaded penalty shootout, which can flip between euphoria and despair in seconds. 9:30, Thursday morning, or 8:05, Thursday evening, on the World Service. In this week's episode of Ramblings, Claire Balding is joined by the CEO of Natural England, Marianne Spain, and Paula Brunt, a campaigner with Disabled Ramblers, as she explores a stretch of the King Charles III English Coast Past in West Sussex, from Bosham to West Itchener. 3 o'clock, Radio 4, Ramblings. And Radio 3 in Concert features a concert for May 10th at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, the BBC Concert Orchestra in programme, including Brahms' Third Symphony and Sibelius's Cariella Suite. 7:30 p.m, Radio 3, Thursday night. Finally, Friday, June 26th, and this week's edition of the food programme focuses on the weight of the world, exploring why obesity has become a global problem, changing relationships with food and reasons for optimism. 11 a.m, Radio 4 on Friday. Petrick Trelawney presents Friday Night Is Music Night with the BBC Concert Orchestra, playing music that has a connection with Brighton Dome, which opened in 1867. The programme includes music by Elgar, Samuel Coleridge Taylor, Grieg, Vaughan Williams and William Walton. 7:30, Radio 3, Friday Night Is Music Night. It's also Free Thinking Night. The Child's Eye View, from navigating AI to living through war or the joy of reading. What makes children's perspectives so distinctive? Free Thinking, Radio 4, 9 o'clock, Friday night. That's it. Thank you to Leslie for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings. TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for the audio described television programmes for Saturday the 20th of June to Friday the 26th of June, compiled by Lisa and read by John. Please note we have included the World Cup matches in the listing as they have a full commentary. On BBC One on Saturday the 20th, you can catch it with Bargain Hunt at 12 noon. And switch across to BBC Two for Homes Under the Hammer at 1:15. There's also James Martin's Islands to Highlands at 12:35 on ITV One, when the celebrity chef takes a trip on the luxury train. Football kicks off at 5:30pm on BBC One with live coverage of the Netherlands versus Sweden, followed by Casualty at 8:30 when Cam has a difficult conversation with Indy. Then there's part 6 of the drama 2 weeks in August at 9:20, when the group become trapped inside the villa by a heatwave. At 10:25, the complete second series of Fun Boys airs with all four episodes of the Irish comedy shown back-to-back. ITV One has the World Cup action at 8pm with Germany versus the Ivory Coast. Over on Channel 4 at 5:55pm, there's a gentle comedy sequel, Fisherman's Friends, One and All, starring James Purefoy. The Cornish Sea Shanty Singers work through the pressures of their newfound success. Followed by a documentary at 8pm, John Snow, A Last Big Story, in which the veteran journalist comes to terms with his recent Alzheimer's diagnosis. Then there's another film at 9:35, Military Wives, starring Kirsten Scott Thomas in a comedy drama based on a true story. Now for Sunday. BBC Two has two cookery programmes with Mary Berry Cook and Cher at 11:35am, followed by Andy Oliver's Fabulous Feasts at 12:05. Then there's Bargain Hunt at 1:15, and ITV One has Love Your Garden at 11:30am, when the team create a wildlife wonderland in West Bromwich. On BBC One at 4:30, it's Spain versus Saudi Arabia, and at 9:15 it's the final episode of Death Valley, starring Timothy Spall. At a memorial service for a rugby club groundsman, another death shocks the attendees. Then it's back to football at 10:30 with Uruguay versus Cape Verde. Explore the hidden treasures of the National Trust over on BBC Two at 5:15pm, focusing on the legendary garden of the designer Gertrude Jekyll. And at 8:15 there's Expedition with Steve Backshall, exploring the remote parts of the planet in search of natural wonders. This is followed by the final episode of the Scottish drama Barlinnie at 9pm. ITV One has the classic movie action at 4:20 with Goldfinger, starring Sean Connery as 007 James Bond, followed by more World Cup at 7pm when Belgium play Iran. Plenty of alternatives are on Channel 4, starting with Billy and Molly, an otter love story, at 4:25pm. The story of a couple moving to Shetland and forming an unlikely bond with a wild otter. There's Kirsty and Phil's Brilliant Builds at 6pm, and at 7pm The Great Celebrity Bake Off features Jodie Whittaker and Paloma Faith, followed by Cruising to the End of the Earth at 8pm, this week visiting Japan and Alaska. Then there's part 2 of Free Nelson Mandela at 9pm, focusing on the song that became the anthem to the global fight for Nelson Mandela's freedom. Finally, catch up with Celebrity Gogglebox at 10 as the armchair critics share their thoughts. Now turning to this week's soap schedule, which will be slightly different to fit round football. Monday, it's EastEnders at 8:30pm on BBC One and Emmerdale and Corrie on ITV One at 8 and 9pm respectively. Tuesday has EastEnders at 7:30pm and Emmerdale and Corrie at 9 and 9:30pm. Wednesday has EastEnders at 7:30pm. Thursday has EastEnders at 7:30pm and Emmerdale at 8pm and Corrie at 9. Moving on to Monday the 22nd of June, BBC One has Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15 and Bargain Hunt at 12:15, which this time comes from Wetherby. Football takes over again at 5:30 with Argentina versus Austria, and another big match at 9:30 when France play Iraq. Some nice alternatives on BBC Two, beginning with the Great Continental Railway Journeys, in which Michael Portillo visits Switzerland. There's Millionaire Superyacht, Why Ships Sink at 8 p.m, followed by the always interesting Lucy Worsley at 9 p.m. in Jack the Ripper, Lucy Worsley Investigates. The historian reveals how the infamous murders of the 1880s influenced how crime is covered in the media today. Then at 10 p.m, it's the gentle charm of Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing, when Bob and Paul accept a special invitation to Burley House. ITV1 has part 4 of Changing Ends, starring National Treasure Alan Carr as himself, at 7:30 p.m, whilst over on Channel 4 at 4 p.m, it's Narrow Escapes, in which Chef Fergus begins transforming his boat into a floating ice cream parlour, followed by Chateau DIY at 5 p.m, and then at 8 p.m. is a brand new series of Dover 24/7, Britain's busiest port. So to Tuesday. BBC One has a double bill of Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30 and Bargain Hunt at 12:15, whilst over on ITV One at 2, Dickinson's Real Deal visits Bridlington. Back to BBC One at 3 p.m. for Escape to the Country, when Andrew and Will hope to escape their busy Oxfordshire town for scenic Devon. At 4:30 p.m, the travelling auctioneers help a mother and a daughter sell the family treasures to fund a home extension. Two big football matches on BBC One this evening, when England kick off against Ghana at 8 p.m. Can Harry Kane add to his goal tally? Panama and Croatia are the other two teams in England's group. They kick off at 11:50 p.m. Over on BBC Two, Michael Portillo continues his tour of Switzerland in Great Continental Railway Journeys at 6:30. And at 8 p.m, it's Digging for Britain with Alice Roberts. A double episode of Scamander airs at 9 p.m. when Amanda's web of lies begins to unravel. ITV1 has Portugal versus Uzbekistan at 5 p.m. and another episode of Changing Ends at 8:35, when Christine's Tupperware party takes a rowdy turn. We've all been there. It's Chateau DIY at 5 p.m. on Channel 4, and at 8 p.m. part 5 of Bake Off, The Professionals. This week, the teams make Bakewell slices. This is followed by part 3 of the drama Light in the Hall, Still Waters, at 9 p.m. when Carol faces a crisis. It's Wednesday and BBC One has Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15, followed by Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Then it's Escape to the Country at 3, when a couple search for a home in rural Lincolnshire. Over on ITV One at 2 p.m, Dickinson's Real Deal visits Solihull. BBC One has the enduringly popular Repair Shop at 8 p.m, and a big match for Scotland at 10 p.m. when they play Brazil. At 6:30 p.m. on BBC Two, Michael Portillo visits Zurich in his Great Continental Railway Journeys, and at 8 p.m, Rob Rinder and Monica Galletti are in Shanghai for Amazing Hotels Life Beyond the Lobby. Another football match at 10:50 when Morocco play Haiti. ITV One offers Switzerland versus Canada at 7 p.m. and nothing else. So it's over to Channel 4 for Narrow Escapes at 4 p.m. when Graham battles the incoming storms, and Chateau DIY at 5 p.m. Then there's part 4 of The Light in the Hall, Still Waters at 9 p.m. followed by Night Coppers at 10 when rookie Matt and his partner Will attend a case of suspected arson in Brighton. Now for Thursday. Catch more Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15 on BBC One and Bargain Hunt at 12:15. This time they're in Hungerford, whilst Dickinson's Real Deal visits Weston-super-Mare over on ITV One at 2 p.m. The evening schedule on BBC One is taken over again by World Cup, with Ecuador versus Germany at 8:30 and Tunisia versus Netherlands at 11:50 for Night Owl football fans. Thank goodness for Michael Portillo on BBC Two at 6:30. Still gamingly touring his way around Switzerland. At 9 p.m, it's Saving Lives at Sea, this week responding to an emergency in Eastbourne Marina where a boat catches fire. More football at 8:50 when Curacao play Ivory Coast. ITV One's sole offering is the final episode of Alan Carr's Changing Ends at 7:30. More Chateau DIY at 5 p.m. on Channel 4. And at 8 p.m, it's George Clark's Beautiful Builds, this time visiting a renovation in Bedfordshire. Much darker fare at 9 p.m, with 24 hours in police custody. and the crime theme continues at 10 p.m. with The Accused, Beyond Reasonable Doubt. And now it's Friday, 26th of June. BBC One has the usual Homes Under the Hammer bargain hunt double bill at 11:15 and 12:15 respectively. Then there's the final episode of Under the Vines at 2 p.m, then Escape to the Country at 2:45. An interesting documentary at 7:30 p.m, What Happened at the Somme? Jordan Dunbar marks the 110th anniversary of their battle by speaking to those who are still discovering the truth about the First World War, followed by A Total Contrast at 8 p.m. by Sort Your Life Out with Stacey Solomon. Catch up with the long-running cosy crime series Death in Paradise at 9 p.m. when a body is discovered on a golf course. On BBC Two at 6:30, Marco Portillo is still in Switzerland, this time travelling from Interlaken to the Swiss Riviera. A highlight for wildlife lovers is My Tiger Family, which tells the epic story of an Indian tiger clan and its five most powerful tigresses in the Indian state of Rajasthan. Then at 10, it's another episode of the darkly comic Inside Number 9, starring Steve Pemberton and Rhys Shearsmith. ITV1 again concentrates on football. The big match this evening is Norway versus France at 7 p.m. More Narrow Escapes on Channel 4 at 4 p.m. and Shatter DIY at 5 p.m. It's part 5 of Our Farm Next Door at 8 p.m. when Amanda, Clive and the kids are making the most of the school holidays, followed by Celebrity Gogglebox at 9 with more wit and wisdom from the armchair critics. Then First Dates rounds off the schedule at 10 p.m. This week, uber-confident boss Joe is introduced to champion speed skater Keith. What could possibly go wrong? And that concludes this week's ADTV listings. Obviously heavily dominated by the World Cup, but hopefully you found something for non-football fans as well.
TNF Soundings.